ladies, thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing your voices to this room. They are beautiful, and we're very, very grateful. And we're welcoming our very sweet speakers up on the stage. We're going to let them get settled. When I started this position earlier this year, I think it was my very first Sunday that I had a woman approach me who I didn't know. She's up on this stage. Her name's Carrie Hahn. And she said, "Is Story Night coming back? Because I know the person it needs to be, and I want to make this happen." So I was immediately intrigued. I said, "I don't know. I'm new here. I'm still figuring it out." She was ready to go. She wanted to have it like in March. I started in January, and I said, "I don't know if I can pull it off that soon." And so she was very kind and waited until I got a little more ready and settled in this position. But she is joined tonight by our honored guest, Melvin Lee Jenkins Ritchie, otherwise known as Mel. And so welcome, Mel. Thank you for being here. I want to give just a little bit of background about how this friendship came to be and how these two are up on this stage. But I am going to have, Carrie can jump in if I'm messing up any details, which I may. We all know that pervasive racial tensions exist inside and outside the walls of the church, and they have for thousands and thousands of years. And often I think Christians are no better than anyone else about speaking out against racism. And back in 2019, think pre-pandemic, pre-George Floyd, our church was looking for ways to just better encourage members to think about what it would look like to bring people together in conversation and to truly try to rise above the issues that divide us. And so there was a couple different book offerings that summer of 2019, and one of them was Myle McPherson's book called The Third Option. And a bunch of different groups of people met, read the book together, and over the course of a couple different meetings discussed it. And Carrie was in one of those book groups, and in it, what she described, I read the book back in 2019 as well, but she reminded me one of the takeaways in that book, or one of the encouragements for white folks, was to get outside the walls of our normal everyday life, whether that's our churches or the clubs that we're a part of. And one idea was to go visit a black church if they had never been to one before. And so Carrie said, "I think I'll do that." And so she went in 2019, met many of these women, and then Carrie, I think what you told me was visited once or twice, and then once the pandemic hit, their church, Greater Hope Missionary Baptist Church, was meeting before we began meeting, and so Carrie said, "I think I'll go, because this church is open," and so from that, she couldn't stop going, and she still attends there. She comes here for our 9 a.m. service and then heads over there most Sundays and attends their service as well. And so over the course of the last several years, got to know Mel and realized that she has a story to tell. And though we all have stories to tell, I assure you of that, every single person in this room, Mel's story is unique because not as many people are still here on earth telling it. It's a story that we sometimes think doesn't exist or didn't happen, especially here in California, way, way far away from Mississippi, or it's something that we've just read about in history books. And so her story is really important, and we're really, really grateful that you're both here tonight. Amen. To tell it. Amen. And so I want to turn the floor over to you both. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you. Amen. Okay.
So you can hear me, right? How about you, Mel? You want to just say hello and make sure we can all hear you through your mic?
Yo, hello.
Well, thank you all for being here. I'm really excited that God has brought us all together. Looking forward to what he has in store for us here. I do want to thank the women of Greater Hope Missionary Baptist Church and New Friendship Missionary Church. What a privilege it's been to have you lead us in worship. Thank you. And we have a couple of additional members who came in full support, and so I want to thank you as well. Normally, Mel would have been singing with the choir. She does every Sunday, but she's been struggling with some sciatica, which some of you probably know something about. And so, actually, we're just praising God that she's here.
Amen. Amen. Yeah.
So, thank you, Leslie, for just giving people some background on how I met Melvin and these other lovely ladies. I think you pretty much covered it, including talking about the book that, you know, led me to the challenge to put myself in a position where I would be the only person of my color. I showed up one Sunday not knowing how I'd be received, and I needed an avori. There was this lovely lady who was dressed in a beautiful pink flowing dress, Sunday dress, and a hat. You will all know who that is, Betty Hughes. And she greeted me with a smile and invited me to sit with her near the front of the sanctuary. And that's where I sit with her to this day, every Sunday. And I'm sure you can all understand why, even when this church started meeting in person again, I just couldn't leave behind Greater Hope. I mean, I get to listen and sing along with that kind of praise music every Sunday, and it's a blessing, I'm telling you. But as Leslie said, the story that Melvin wanted to share with me was such an important one that I wanted to share with all of you. But she has some words to tell you about that, because the collaboration that we have formed is you know what really helped our friendship deepen. So I'm going to let her tell you a little bit about that.
Well, I have to say that I'm grateful to have met Carrie, because it turned out to be something that was really wonderful for me. Mm. And coming from someone who I didn't know anything before she came to Greater Hope, you know, but we just got to talk, and we were talking about things that I had done or things that she had seen, right? Is that what I'm? And since she had seen those things about me, she was telling me after she started coming to Greater Hope, and I was coming to Greater Hope, and so, you know, but she was telling me, well, I saw what they said about you, and I thought that it would be something that I would maybe like to help you. And I said, and I was just getting ready to do all of my stuff, my life story, you know. And she said, well, I want to help you. And I said, you want to help me? So she said, yeah. I said, well, okay. Let's go for it, you know. And we did that. And just doing that, and it took us a while to get it all together, because I am a Mississippian, and Mississippi people went through a lot of people stuff, you know. And but she said, "Yeah, I want to help you." I said, "Okay," and that was enough for me, because I said, "Then God is on my side one more time, because He sent me somebody that to help me to get to where I was trying to go," and that's to get something that my children, my five children, my 14 great grand, my 17 great great, and I probably have some more. I don't know. With a lot of kids, you know, and I wanted to do something that my kids, not only my kids, but my kids, to understand about where their mom and their grandmother, where she came from, and what happened in her lifetime, you know. And not only is that a good way I wanted to tell my children, but it's a good way I wanted to let people know that no matter who you are and where you are, we're all God's children. I don't care how we look at it, but it's not going to change anything, because we are His children. And so I was taught that very early in my lifetime. And I said, okay, my children need to know some of this stuff that I'm talking about, as well as other people that I would like to get them to hear what I'm talking about, to see what that would mean to them, you know? And so Carrie was one of the people that God sent my way. And I am so grateful for that. I don't know if I would have made it out to get all of the stuff that I'm saying doing without help. Because the one thing was, You know, I work all of my life. I've been in church all of my life. But I had got to the point where I was just, not only was I wanted to do this stuff, but I also became 80 years old. So, you know, and I go, 80 years old, you know, and I'm going, okay, God, you got me here. I don't want to go nowhere else right now, but, you know, but I'm here. So I guess what we did is got to talking about stuff on and on and on and on until, you know. But anyway, we met up. She came to Greater Hope, and so that's how we met up. I think that what was done by, you know, any person, I guess, but I was getting ready to start my life story. And so once she knew that, and then she had already known about me a little bit anyway beforehand, but so, and we sat, and so we did, we said, okay, we tried, we stopped her that at that point, but then it was I guess what I'm reading, let me see, it was the school we talked about, but it also was, there's another place there somewhere, I'm trying to see that. Oh, we talked about Mississippi, right? Then we talked about how we lived on Mississippi. And and Carrie was so taken about the Mississippi thing, you know, and she wanted to hear more. And that's why we started putting stuff together, you know, for that.
So that's when we finally landed with this book, which yeah. is available, as some of you have seen, out in the front. We're going to be sharing details from this book, but actually, we're not going to be able to share everything tonight. So I do encourage you to consider picking up a copy here, because there are some amazing stories and anecdotes from the book. And I want to give people some background on what it was like for people, black people in general, in the South in the 1940s when mm-hmm. you were when you were born. And they're all looking up here, and you and I can look back there, and we can see what's on the screen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Melvin was born in 1944, and at that point, some people were breaking down some of the racial barriers. This woman up in the top corner, Hattie McDaniel, she was given the first Academy Award to a person of color for her role in Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman in the other corner, Jackie Robinson, was the first to break the barrier in major league sports. The gentleman in the middle were the Tuskegee Airmen, and during World War II, they distinguished themselves as superior fighters. And of course, they were fighting for freedom and yeah. for rights mm-hmm. That they actually were not afforded when they returned home. All of these people were running into barriers if they lived in the South mm-hmm. or if they traveled through the South. And everywhere they turned, Jim Crow laws were in full effect. At theaters, restaurants, stores, mm-hmm. hotels, you name mm-hmm. it. Even basic rights like having the right to vote was made difficult for them, and that's that little picture there about the poll tax as a reminder of that. Mm-hmm. So as a result, there were people, this last picture, people who were leaving in great numbers. In mm-hmm. fact, it was called the Great Migration.
Yeah.
And so black Americans were leaving the South, moving north or heading out west in search of a better life. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was something, you know, more like what most Americans were enjoying at the time. Here's some pictures here, you know, in the bottom corner. The houses, most average Americans were living in homes that looked something like that. Yeah. However, people who were sharecroppers living in the South were pretty much living on the property that was owned by the plantation owner.
Yeah.
They were living in housing that was provided by their owners
and they weren't nearly as nice. While many American women were starting to enjoy the luxuries in their homes of electric stoves and ovens, running water, refrigeration, women on the plantations were making do with cupboards. And perhaps one cupboard could be designated to hold a block of ice in the summertime to try and keep things cool, but they had no running water. Mel's family shared a pump outside with their neighbors. Mm-hmm. They had no electricity. They used gas lamps at night. Mm-hmm. And for heat and for cooking, they had wood-burning stoves. Again, many American women were living in relative comfort, like you see at this bottom corner, whereas the women on the plantations were not. And the other reality was that in the South, every person of color worked. Men, women, children. The children were allowed to attend school, of course, but actually they attended fewer months out of every year than their white counterparts. Mm-hmm. Now, this picture on the bottom corner, it shows women and men who are picking cotton, and those bags that they're dragging behind them, those sacks, is what they had to fill with the cotton. And that's actually tied to Mel's earliest memory. I think it's probably your earliest memory. And so I wanted you to tell them what you remember. What's that vision that's in your head about sitting on your mom's sack?
Oh, well, I'm the baby of the family, and my sisters and my brother, they had gone away, you know, to other places, and we would go to the field to pick the cotton or whatever they were going to do, chop the cotton, whatever it was. And I was just a baby and riding on my mom's cotton sack, you know, as she goes down. And I really think that was the first thing that I ever knew was the things that were coming out of, all the stuff that they have there, you know.
Like
so,
picking
yeah,
the cotton and throwing it in the sack, right?
Yeah, they were taking the cotton and putting it in the bag or the sack. Mm-hmm. And I'm a baby, so I don't know anything about that at that point. But as I grew older, I got a little bigger. Then they give you they make the little cotton sacks for you to put on the children, so the children can learn how to start, you know, picking the cotton.
Right. So tell them what happened when your mom was ready to give birth to you.
Oh yeah, well, my mom, after 10 children, my mom was in the field and working, and she had to come out the field to deliver me.
Yeah.
And
right out of the field.
You know, that I was a little child. I was a baby child, you know, like and I didn't know anything obviously, but
and they weren't sure you were going to make it.
Yeah, they weren't sure that I was going to make it. Cuz I was a really little child, you know. Like maybe born a little bit earlier than I maybe should have been, but my brother, my last brother that I have that we have now, his name is Walter. He called me this name, and I always forget the name, you know, that he called me. But it was some kind of name that he would always call me because of how I was born, you know, and then as I grew up, of course, then I gave him a name. So, you know, but it was just that time, you know. So I don't know whether I may have been born earlier than I should have been, but I was really little, so little baby.
But these are your parents here. We're showing everybody Peter and Annie.
My mom was married to Peter Jenkins, and my mom was. Annie.
Mm-hmm. And you've told me they were quiet people, but hard workers.
Quiet people, not big talkers.
No.
Yeah. I'm not a big talker even now, but sometimes when I'm talking to my children, though, they think I, they think I'm, well, and the grandchildren, Grandma, what'd you say about that? You know, but I would tell them the same thing that my mom told me, my dad told me, you know.
Yeah.
You take care of each other.
Yeah.
You go to church. You put God first no matter what, you know. And take care of yourself and your own people. Mm-hmm. Take care. Mm-hmm. You know, people out there, they had a lot of sickness, people, because you didn't always go to a doctor and all of those things, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said we had to go to help other people, mm-hmm. you know, that didn't go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. But we go and we help like we were doctors, you know. But good for us, our parents, our foreparents, my grandfather, my grandmother, you know, they had taught their children how to work, mm-hmm. how to help each other. Mm-hmm. That passed on to us, mm-hmm. you know. So that's all we knew, too. Yeah, that's right. What you do, you know.
Right.
And I thank God for that.
And you're seeing her grandparents, her mom's parents here.
Oh, there's my grandpa mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a black person, but she also was...
American Indian, Native American.
Yeah, Native American.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they were good people.
Mm-hmm.
They raised their own food.
Mm-hmm.
They took care of their own children.
Mm-hmm.
My mom came from... It was 14 of them, and her sisters was named Melvin. When I was born, that's how I got the name Melvin.
Yeah,
just from my auntie.
Yeah,
and so that was nice. But they had moved on, you know, to mm-hmm. other places mm-hmm. like Chicago and other places that they could do better.
Right,
you know, and so I was still home. My mom and my dad raised another child.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was ill, and my mom used to go and see her and everything. And she'd always told my mom, "If I die, I want you to take care of this my mm-hmm. child.
Mm-hmm.
If she doesn't, I want you to be her godmother, mm-hmm. you know, or his mm-hmm. godmother." And so that happened. The lady died when the baby was about 3 weeks old. And their grandparents had come to get them, but they were older people, and they couldn't do anything with the child because the child was born sickly. And so they brought him to my mom, and we raised him. We raised him to know that he had children. He had actually, you know, kin children of his own, you know, from his family.
Mm-hmm.
And we named him, you know, and we took care of him and everything. He was born sickly. My mom had to take him to a doctor or something. Maybe I don't know what they did to him because I was still young.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they did to him, but they did whatever she took him to do, you know. So, and then they would bring him back home, you know. And then we raised him.
Well, in addition to your wonderful, loving family, you also were very, like you said earlier, very much part of the church. That was your second family.
Yeah.
And I'd love for you to share with them your first memories of talking to God.
Oh, my God. You know, you go to always in church. I've been in church ever since I knew myself. But you know, people tell you about God, and you know, you go to church, and they tell you about what you need to do. You know, if you need to get to know God, you know, and so you can, you know, you can understand who's taking care of you, you know, so to speak. So
so you'd sit in your garden.
My garden. I love gardening, but I would go to my garden after we got off of work. I go to my garden. My mom didn't know why I was going to the garden because she knew I loved to work the garden, but she didn't know why I was going out there after I got off of work, right? So I had to go out there because I wanted to know God. I wanted to know who God was. Because they tell you, you know, you go to church, you got to learn who he was, right? And I said, okay. So I went, and so I asked God, oh, God, How are you today? Yeah. How's your wife? Why's your wife? Where are you? But, you know, my mom didn't know I was doing that, right? But I would do that, and then it gets almost dark. My mom would say, you have to come in the house. So I'd come in that house, okay, and I'd still go back the next day, same thing, go to their garden, them same thing. Oh, God, where are you? You know, and several times I probably did that. And then one day I went to that garden, and I said, okay, God, where are you? And just waiting and still waiting on him to tell me, you know. But after a while, there was something that hit me. And from here, all the way up to glory, wherever God was. And I tell you, that point on, I knew who God was. He let me know who he was,
yeah.
You know. And so, and I would just, when mama said the dog, he got to come in, I go to bed. And all I could think about was what happened with me and God, you know, in the garden. You know, and I would just fall asleep thinking about it. The next day or whatever, I was back again.
Yeah.
You know, but he got to the point where I really understood, and I really knew that he knew me, because he said something. He didn't. It wasn't talking like I'm talking to you, but it was hit me so hard. It was. I knew who it was.
Yeah.
You know, and I believed him. From that point on, me and God have been together, you know. He brought me through a lot of things, you know. I mean, I didn't get to this 80 years old, you know, for nothing. I mean, I came through some stuff,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I was glad that I had got to know him for myself.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to wait on my mom to keep telling me. You know?
Tell us about these people here, your teachers. You know, they were important people. There's one man in particular in the corner there. He was your principal. What'd you think of him?
Oh, yeah, in the thing up there. A principal was a good person. He knew God as well.
Uh-huh.
Every Saturday, I'm not saying every Friday, we go to church. He opened up with something about God.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, his wife was a really good lady.
Yeah.
And the other people there that was there was good people.
Yeah, and just below him is a woman sitting in a chair, Mrs. Henry.
Yeah.
And she was special to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know she really gave Mel one of her favorite memories. She had their second grade class put on a play called Little May's Birthday Cake. And Melvin got to play Little May. And there's somebody else who was in that play with you. Uh-huh. Who was that?
Where is she?
Remember? Oh. Mary, one of our choir singers tonight.
raise your hand, Mary. Raise your hand.
Yeah, raise your hand. Mary was in that.
I did all the talking. She only came through there, running through there with her hand in her mouth. You know,
but they go way back.
Yeah, we go way back. We do.
And there's a woman sitting in the opposite corner, Miss Compton.
Yeah.
And what was special about her? What did she do for you?
Miss Compton.
She was the piano.
Oh,
teacher.
She played piano.
Mm-hmm.
And she, they was always giving me something to do on a program or something. So she would play whatever song they wanted me to sing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know. And it was something about something jumped over the hill or something. I don't even remember. What
Hey Diddle Diddle.
Huh?
Hey Diddle Diddle, the cat and the fiddle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All that kind of stuff.
But she taught you a few notes on the piano. She started to teach you to play.
She played the piano, so she was going to teach us how to use the piano. She only did it about one or two times, and then she could not do that anymore because they didn't think that we were worthy of knowing how to.
The white community stopped her and didn't think that they needed to know how to play a piano.
Right.
But there's more on that later on in your life we'll come back to.
Right.
So Melvin finished the eighth grade and could have gone through the ninth grade, but decided that she needed to stop going to school and start working in the fields to help her family.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So she picked cotton, but she also was called upon to do a special job. And so tell them what you did for Mr. Jefferson here.
Oh, Mr. Jefferson was a person who was running everything in the garden and
in the field,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And but the boss man, what he did was just take care of the people was working the cotton and how much they weighed in the cotton. Mm-hmm. He had to take, you know, write up in it. Yeah, it up. Mm-hmm. So the boss man, this man was getting older. So the boss man had called me into the office one day. I think I was about 12. Mm-hmm. He says, well, I want you to help
Jefferson.
Jefferson. Mm-hmm. And he called him something else. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I want you to help him because he can't see very well. So I have to write up all the stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So you're going to pay me
27 cents
an hour. I was taken by that because he wanted me to do some work for him. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, okay, I was happy because I'm now I can make some money. Mm-hmm. You know, and make some money. And I really thought about it because I knew that people would, even when I was going to school, I knew that there were people and teachers and whoever there had learned how to do really good jobs for people and made good money. Mm-hmm. This is what I thought when he told me that, right?
Yeah, it's a big opportunity.
Which is really
how this book came to get its title. You know, I found my window. Well, Mel has had windows of opportunity that God's provided her throughout her life. And I would say this was really one of the first ones. Mm-hmm. It gave you some encouragement that maybe you could someday leave in the plantation and do something different, like bookkeeping.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yes.
So Melvin and several of these women here tonight, they grew up living outside of Clarksdale, Mississippi, mm-hmm. and didn't often go into town. And, you know, again, there were lots of barriers. But there was one day when you went into town with your older sister and her husband. Mm-hmm. And share with us this one vivid memory that you have.
We passed by, you know, a place where there was a house there, and there was a little boy who was playing in this house. And I was with my sister and her husband, and I was still small then. I didn't, you know. And I was just, he said something to us. And I when I was younger, I used to remember that name that he used, but I forgot it. But I always remembered him by what he wore. Mm-hmm. Even today, I know exactly what he wore. I knew he had white hair. Mm-hmm. And he said something to us. And that, you know, that was it. But that's all I got from him. But,
you know. You couldn't figure out why he had said something cruel to you because they were just walking by. But it was also a reason why you were never too excited to go into town anyway.
Oh, yeah, I don't think I even wanted to go to town.
Yeah, yeah.
But my sister, sometimes, and her husband, sometimes because I was the youngest child at home then, so they would always do things with me and take me places or something, you know.
Well, I wanted you all to see this picture in the top corner because that was the pharmacy that was owned by Mrs. Henry's husband, who was affectionately known as Doc Henry. And I found when I looked him up on the internet that he was actually quite an influential man in the civil rights movement.
Right.
And at one point, he took up for the all-black high school band when that band was barred from performing in the town's Christmas parade. They were excluded. So he organized a boycott of the white businesses, and for his efforts, his home was firebombed, and his mm-hmm. business was vandalized. And actually, his business was later firebombed because of the work that he was continuing to do. So you can imagine that with that kind of thing happening to people that they knew, in a, you know, right near them, oops, wrong way, they, you know, that was not a hospitable place to be living. And so Mel took another window of opportunity that came along. Mm-hmm. She started to meet and spend some time with a young man, David Ritchie. And again, because of the climate that they lived in, he decided to follow his parents to Florida and looking for better work, and invited Mel to come and join him and marry him.
And that's how I got married.
Yep, yeah.
And I tell you, I said, to get out of Mississippi for a little while was I wasn't old enough to get married. I was 17. So you had to be at least 18, or you had to have your mother's or your father's, you know, okay for you to get married. So we got pregnant. Then we got married.
But you didn't stay in Florida.
No, I didn't stay in Florida. We came back to Mississippi and to my mom and my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our first child there.
In 1962, little David Jr. Was born. Yeah. But they didn't stay in Mississippi for very much longer because David and his brother decided to try another place.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to move out here to a little town called Santa Barbara.
Right.
And they went first, David and his brother, and then shortly after, Melvin and her sister-in-law got on a bus with their infant children mm-hmm. and rode out here to join them.
Mm-hmm.
So another window of opportunity had opened up. And when they got here, they joined Melvin's sister and her husband, who had come out here with five of their children, sons. And Melvin ended up helping to take care of those sons while her sister-in-law and brother-in-law went out and got work.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those little boys is Bob Thompson. And some of you may know Bob from the community. I knew him before I came to Greater Hope because he worked at the Boys and Girls Club and was the director, I believe. And he's also worked in the financial community here in town. He was also a Westmont student, so some of you may even know him from there. But his wife, Gwen, is here with us tonight, which is a real privilege. So they're very close-knit, this church. And they go, like I said, they go way back. Oops, once again, I did the wrong one. So they settled in Santa Barbara, eventually got their own place, and soon after they welcomed their daughter, Dwalette, who was born in 1964.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then 2 years after that, a son, Andre, was born. And as well as being a mother of three, Mel started getting some part-time jobs around town. And with some of her earnings, she bought herself a piano.
Yes, I did.
And she started teaching herself how to play. I mean, she built on just those few things that her teacher was able to impart to her before the white women stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
But she taught herself how to play. And that enabled her to sometimes help play at Sunday school at the church or to fill in for her good friend, Bernice, who we all got to hear play tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And they started out at New Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, which is up in the corner. Yes, that's right. Woo-hoo. And they were joining, you know, other friends and family who had moved out here from Mississippi. But then a little while after that, again, a friend from Mississippi, J.B. Ficklin Jr., who is the brother of Bernice, who played the piano, and Mary, who was in Little May's birthday cake play. He took on the head, being the head pastor of Greater Hope Missionary Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. And one of his daughters was leading our choir tonight, Bernice.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah. So she and David moved over to that church in order to help, build that church up. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, they have to pass the Ficklin.
Yep. And she's there to this day. Yeah.
Right.
So while she was, at this point, she's only about 24 years old. And again, mother of three at that point. Mm-hmm. And she applied for a job at a nursing home. And so they had her come in and work one night. And then they sent her to the a doctor to get a routine physical in order to be able to continue with the job. And I want you to tell them what happened when you went in for that physical.
Oh, yeah. I had a kidney problem. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. But so we went in to the doctor, and he says, okay. And the doctor, he's always calling me Melvy. Well, Melvin, come on in here, and I'll just go do that, and yeah, you can go to work. You know, and I had worked that one night, but then what happened when they found the kidney thing, and so, which I never knew I had, and he says, well, we have to take this out. So he and the other people that really knew about dealing with that kind of surgery, you know. Mm-hmm. So he had those two with him. Mm-hmm. So he says, okay, so we got to take this out. That's okay. So they did that. And then it set up something. Then they went in again. That was the second time. Then, again, we waited a little while. Then I went in a third time, and he had to take that kidney out because it had abscessed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I never knew I had that. And so, you know, I think I was what?
24.
24.
Yeah.
I think I was about maybe 3 months before I could got out of all of that, you know.
Right.
And then I had to wait a long time because it bothered my, when they was in here, bothered my, this side mm-hmm. here. And, you know, I had to walk. You're funny and all that kind of stuff. So they were trying to help me get all that stuff done, you know. But
and what was your greatest worry?
Oh, my greatest worry was that I had three children at the time, me and David. And I didn't know what was going on with me. So I didn't know. I asked God, said, well, if you're going to take me, don't let me go worried about my children, my three children. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, it just happened. Once I heard that, and once I said that to him, and I said, okay, you know. So then I didn't worry about, you know, my children anymore at that point, you know. And so, but every morning that I would wake up, I would say, Lord, I'm still here, you know. And I was there for some time, let me tell you. And I first thought that, where are my family? My family in Mississippi, a lot of them in Mississippi still. I knew that they wouldn't be able to come out there to see me, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about it, and I was saying to, you know, well, I don't know why that's happening. But one day or night, I went to sleep, obviously. But God came to me that night, and He made me so happy. I was just laughing, and I, you know, put my hand over my mouth so I wouldn't wake the lady next to me. And so, I was happy because he was speaking to me, and I knew that it was him. And so, when I woke up that morning, the first thing this lady said to me, she said, "I heard you laughing in your sleep last night." I said, "What about God?" He let me know it had. If I would have thought I dreamed if I had not got that from him, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and that was it. So, finally got out of the
Yeah, yeah, like he didn't
went,
leave you alone.
Went home, you know,
yeah.
and stuff. But I never forget, I will never forget God. He's always been on my side, no matter what,
right.
You know.
Right. Well, you did recover, and a few years later, in 1971, you welcomed your daughter, Lysandria, who you affectionately call Lan.
Yes.
And again, life seemed to be going really well. David had a good job out at the airport. You had some good jobs with your children's school. You know, her older children were plugged in at Franklin Elementary, and all seemed well. And then, in 1973... David announced that he thought you should move back to Mississippi.
Yeah.
Yeah, hard to believe. So you sold many of your things, including that piano that you had worked so hard to buy.
Yeah.
And you all packed up and you moved back to Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so there you were. You found yourself back on the plantation. Conditions were a little bit better, but still.
About the same.
Yeah, yeah. You told me that you only saw all day, you know, while the three kids went off to school, you only saw the mailman and the bus driver.
That's all.
And otherwise you were home with baby Lan. And as far as your kids were concerned, they were missing Santa Barbara. And so I want you to tell them that little story about what David Jr. said.
Oh, yeah. Our oldest son was just, young. I forget what age he was. He was still young.
Yeah.
Anyway, he had started playing with things around that place, you know, mm-hmm. in the country, which they had they don't know nothing about the country, right? And so... But something happened. He stepped on something, mm-hmm. had to go to the doctor because it's bleeding on his leg or something. And so then I think he got stuck by a bee or something. And it was three different things. Anyway, he went to go to the doctor on that because he had hurt his leg. And so, when we got over to the doctor to see about him, he was crying and crying and crying. Mom, I'm going to have to go back to Mississippi because I'm going to kill myself. Because so many things was happening to him, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't even kill myself.
He was not a country boy.
No, right.
So then another window came up. Melvin decided to go to her husband, David, and tell him that she thought they ought to move back to Santa Barbara. And it was a pretty short conversation.
Yeah, I did. I said, David, I said, I'm going to go back. He said, well, you know, I think you're right. I think you're right. I said, okay. And I didn't dream enough, nothing about that night. But when I got up, it was going. It was telling me to go. And I told, so he said, well, you might be right. So I got my three kids at the time and came back.
Yeah, and you actually had four at that point because you had baby Lan.
So
she sold a lot more things and bought the bus tickets, and David didn't go with her.
And we came.
She took that window on her own. So here she is in front of church, Greater Hope, with her two daughters, and I'm sure the boys are running around outside.
Oh, yeah.
But it seemed like you were alone, and yet you came back to a family, you know, of friends and relatives in the church who mm-hmm. helped you get established. She found a place to live. She got started on welfare. She got the kids back in school. And then mm-hmm. once she found daycare for Lan, she was able to start working. So God definitely provided, you know, mm-hmm. amazingly. And in the years ahead, she also relied some on food stamps to make ends meet. And she was asked, along with one of her girls, to pose for these pictures that were taken as part of a campaign mm-hmm. to show people who is being helped by food stamps, you know. And it was people mm-hmm. like Melvin, you know, single moms trying to make it on their own. And then came another window that Mel took advantage of. She decided to go back to school and get her high school diploma. But there was a particular teacher at Santa Barbara City College, where she was pursuing this diploma, who encouraged her not to stop there, but to keep going and get her AA degree.
Mm-hmm.
So amazingly, with all that she was doing at home, she graduated in 1980 with both her high school diploma and her AA degree.
Yeah.
And you know, this award at the bottom is, it's hard to read, I think, but she was also given an award because she was a peer counselor to other students in the midst of that. Yeah. Plus, she was volunteering at the jail once a month to lead Bible study for women. And every morning before she went to school, she would make lunch and breakfast and drop it off at the home of a friend from church. Mm-hmm. And so she was looking after her. Well, once she graduated, she started working at Santa Barbara Bank and Trust.
Yeah.
And in 1982, she met a special man named Al Reese. And by then, she and David had divorced officially. Mm-hmm. And she began dating Al. And then in 1984, they welcomed their daughter, Ashley. So that rounded out her family to five children.
Yeah.
And then she also decided to go through yet another window and go back to get another degree. And this one was a business degree in computer business management.
Right.
I know, amazing, right? There was actually more going on in her life at home, too. She was taking in relatives, family members, you know, and trying to help them. So, again, it's a lot more in the book. But in 1987, she went to work for the Better Business Bureau. Although, tell them what you thought when you first started there in the first couple of days.
They were close to our house at that time, so I took the walk over there. But they were not in a house, just a regular house.
Sure.
Church,
like a small office building, right in the residential neighborhood, though.
Like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so when I went in there, I don't know, the church, it just wasn't good, you know. So, and I was thinking to myself, I'm going to have to find me another job. But after about 3 months, I began to understand what they were doing. And I began to like what I saw. Because it was, the BBB is a great place to be. It was a great place for me to work. I mean, I spent 18.
Yeah.
You know,
helping people. That's what drew you to them.
Yeah. So I got to know it that well, and I loved what I was doing.
Right.
And so, stayed there.
Starting in 1987, she stayed there for 18 years. But then, that same year, 1987, yet another window opened up for her to serve. Actually, at this time. So, sadly, she discovered that one of her precious children was struggling with drug abuse.
Yeah.
And when she reached out to friends and neighbors, she found that other parents were struggling with worry for their children as well. So she organized a committee. First of all, it started out as a big meeting, a neighborhood meeting at the Franklin Center. Somebody from the police department came to address the parents, the concerned parents there. And what you see here is an article. It was almost a full-page article that was in the Santa Barbara News Press. Back in 1989, they ran a five-part series called The Invisible Community. And the subtitle was Black Professionals Talking About Their Lives in a Community That Does Not Reflect Their Heritage. And she was highlighted as one of those five people because as the title reads, she turned her own fear into hope for local youth. So tell them what came out of that first meeting, what you founded.
Oh, well, a lot of people came to that first meeting. And you know, and there were people from the teachers that came too, and I was looking for basically help. What I'm going to do for my daughter, who was, you know, going on off the wrong way, and the reason when that happened, I had a dream about my daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was like she was laying on a place like she was going to die. But she had these great, you know, eyes and stuff, you know. So the only thing I could see was her eye moving. For me, when I saw that, when I dreamed that, I knew I had to do something for my child. And that's what that was all about. I was starting another thing.
Right, and it was something that was going to help other people's children. It's the right. Endowment for Youth Committee.
Right.
Right. Tell us how that committee tried to help other young children.
Well, the schools, first of all, their schools were saying that they had children who needed help, you know. And so we started a place or a park working with the schools, with those children who need the help.
To encourage them, to give them hope, to build up their self-esteem.
Right.
And that was done through, they had big gala fundraising events. They had track meets, lots of different activities that were aimed at promoting self-esteem and a hope for the future.
Right.
At one point, the Santa Barbara News Press honored her along with somebody else who had worked on the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign. Some of you may remember that. But they, at the same time, they honored Mel for contributing to our community through the Endowment for Youth.
Right, exactly.
She also contributed in other ways. In the top corner, you see her there with a group of people who were part of the Neighborhood Advisory Committee. And that was formed by the police department. They divided our city up into different neighborhoods. I think there were five. And they appointed committees for each of the neighborhoods to go in and try and address they were trying to address the crime. There was a big problem with crime at the time. And so this committee would go around, canvass the neighborhoods, and look for things that they could do to sort of clean up the neighborhoods. I mean, everything right. from improving, you know, the curbs, mm-hmm. adding trash cans. Big thing was adding lights. Lights, and we went for a drive through the neighborhood a few months ago, and she showed me how there was this beautiful little park tucked mm-hmm. away on the east side, but that's where the druggies would go to do their thing. And so they installed lights. You know, mm-hmm. something as simple as bringing light yes. into the darkness, mm-hmm. you know, it started to transform the neighborhood. And so Mel's contribution went beyond the Better Business Bureau, beyond yeah. the Endowment for Youth Committee, and, you know, into her neighborhoods as well. And mm-hmm. because of her involvement in the community, at one point, she was asked by her friend to portray Rosa Parks right here
oh, yeah.
when there was this reenactment to, you know, honor and acknowledge what Rosa Parks did for the civil rights movement.
Right.
But here's the thing, you know, Melvin had done so much for so many, but at one point she reached her limit and started to struggle with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh yeah,
yeah, and she found her way to a place called New Beginnings, and they helped her kind of get back on her feet. Helped mm-hmm. her with tools and tips for how to overcome this paralyzing anxiety, right. you know, that you mm-hmm. were experiencing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it took me about a year mm-hmm. actually,
mm-hmm.
and because I've never had anything like that before, so right. I wasn't sure what it was,
yeah.
you know. But when I found out what it was. Then I love walking. I was a great walker. So, and what they told me to do is to, if I was gonna, whatever I was gonna do at home, if I was washing or if I was cooking, if I started feeling bad, funny, you know, strange, just leave it alone, you know. And so I started doing that. And I started doing everything like that. Mm-hmm. If I was walking somewhere, I would go walk because I love walking. And I'd walk, and then I'd come home. If I was doing something in my house and I started feeling bad, I would stop. And it took me about a year to really get back to my normal self, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. So I thank God for that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and once she did sort of get past that really difficult time, she realized she needed to pull back. So you ended up leaving the Better Business Bureau. You had already pulled back from the endowment.
Yeah.
But she started to take it a little bit slower. But she didn't stop altogether.
Right.
She's actually written two books and started a third. The one that shows her on the cover is a beautiful collection of poems, some skits, words of encouragement, and a little bit of history about her parents, her family. We've got some of those excerpts in the back of this book here. Mm-hmm. And then tell them about the book that you wrote for your grandson, Eli.
Oh, Eli. Eli was small. You know, this is when he was small, when I started thinking about the book for him. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time to even get it done.
Well, you drew some pictures. You embedded photos of him in your drawings. And then he took it to school. And what happened
there? Oh, he went to school and he took it with him.
Yeah.
And his teacher had it read three times, I think.
Yeah. The kids all loved it so much.
You know, when they were having this their service there, you know. So he called me when he came home, when Eli came home. Grandma, he read my book three times.
Yeah.
I said, he did? He said, yeah. Oh. I said, well, hallelujah. You know? So he was so happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and in addition to doing these things on the side, she still continues to serve at Greater Hope. Mm-hmm. She leads Sunday school every Sunday. She sings in the choir. And then once a month as a deaconess, she helps with the communion. So you've slowed down, but you definitely haven't stopped. So that, in like I said, it doesn't do her life justice. You know, we don't have enough time to do that. But that, in a nutshell, is how God opened some windows for Melvin, and she went through them and answered his calling, and did that with him by her side the whole way.
Oh yeah.
So, and like she said at the beginning, that's what she wanted her children and her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren to know. And I think it's really a privilege that she wanted us to know that, too. So thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.